University.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is a serious issue. We either comply with international law or we don't. But we only have strength in our arguments because we comply with international law.
As Britain suspends some arms exports to Israel over its war on Gaza, we'll speak to the acclaimed Pakistani-British historian Tariq Ali about Gaza, Pakistan, Antony Blinken's visit to the UK today, and more.
Britain has cut off some arms supplies to Israel, but purely for symbolic reasons. They mean nothing. They have nil impact on the genocide that is taking place in Palestine today.
Then as the official death toll in Gaza tops 41,000, we'll speak to former presidential candidate Ralph Nader about why the death toll may be a vast undercount.
There's going to be 500,000 Gazans that are going to die before the end of this year, not only from the bombing, but from the effect of the bombing in terms of the destruction of the healthcare system, infectious diseases.
We'll also talk to Ralph Nader about tonight's debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the Gaza Strip, at least 40 Palestinians were killed, scores more injured this morning as an Israeli strike ripped through a tent encampment housing displaced Palestinians near Khan Yunis. Israel had designated the area as a so-called safe zone. Witnesses say at least four missiles ripped through the crowded camp as people slept, engulfing tents in flames, scattering body parts. The United Nations says its efforts to vaccinate hundreds of thousands of Palestinian children against polio were further delayed after members of a UN convoy were detained by Israel's military at gunpoint for more than 8 hours Monday in northern Gaza. This is UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk.
Ending the war and averting a full-blown regional conflict is an absolute and urgent priority. Equally, the wider situation of illegality across the occupied Palestinian territory, deriving from Israel's policies and practices, as so clearly spelled out by the International Court of Justice in its advisory opinion in July, must be comprehensively addressed.
Monday marked the traditional first day of school in Gaza, but for a second year in a row, classes are canceled for all of Gaza's school children. Action Aid Palestine said in a statement, quote, going to school is not a luxury, it's a fundamental right, and yet hundreds of thousands of children in Gaza are being denied an education for the second academic year in a row. A whole generation is being denied the opportunity to learn and build a better future for themselves, unquote. In the occupied West Bank, mourners held a funeral procession Monday for the Turkish-American activist Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi, who was fatally shot in the head by Israeli forces Friday while she joined a protest against illegal Israeli settlements in the town of Beita. Witnesses say she was killed by an Israeli sniper after the demonstration had already dispersed. This is Lulu, another U.S. activist in the West Bank.
They're all very saddened by this. My heart and my thoughts are with her family, and we as volunteers here, we feel her loss. But we're not scared off by the Israelis. We are not scared off by this attack. We will continue to stay here in solidarity with the Palestinians for as long as we live, no matter what happens.
Ayşenur's family is calling on the Biden administration to order an independent investigation into the unlawful killing of a U.S. citizen and to ensure full accountability. On Monday, the State Department appeared to rule out a U.S.-led probe, saying it would wait for the results of an Israeli investigation.
I think most important is to let this process play out for the facts to be gathered and for those to come to light. And I will just leave it at that.
To see our coverage of Ayşenur Aygi's killing and growing calls for justice around her death, visit democracynow.org. Russia's military says shot down 144 drones launched from Ukraine at targets inside Russia in an overnight wave of attacks that killed a 46-year-old woman in her Moscow home. Three others were injured as the blast tore through a high-rise apartment building early this morning, setting other residential buildings on fire. Witnesses described a chaotic scene.
We were asleep. I got up to go to work. I looked through the window and saw a ball of fire. I had just a second to cover my spouse with a blanket. The window got smashed out by a shockwave.
Everything is messed up there.
We were in shock. I grabbed whatever was nearby, children, the dog, everything, and ran away because we thought that our home would collapse as well.
Ukrainian officials have yet to comment on their latest drone attacks on Russia. On Monday, NATO warned Moscow over violations of Latvian and Romanian airspace by Russian drones, calling them irresponsible and potentially dangerous. Latvian officials said they recovered wreckage of an Iranian-designed Shahed drone that crashed 60 miles from Latvia's border with Belarus on Saturday. Meanwhile, Sweden's government says it's preparing to transfer Saab fighter jets to Ukraine as part of an increase and Swedish arms shipments. Texas is suing the Biden administration over federal privacy rules that bar investigators from viewing medical records of patients who travel out of state to have an abortion. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton says the rule creates a, quote, backdoor attempt at weakening Texas's laws, unquote, which ban nearly all abortions. In Missouri, an amendment that could undo the state's near total abortion ban is at risk of being removed from the ballot after a Missouri judge ruled Friday the campaign to get the ballot measure did not sufficiently explain the amendment in the signature gathering phase. Missourians for Constitutional Freedom, the group behind the ballot measure, is arguing its case today before the state Supreme Court, which will need to make an immediate decision since today is also the deadline for any ballot changes before they're printed for mail-in voters. Meanwhile, the Nebraska Supreme Court heard arguments Monday in lawsuits against two separate abortion ballot measures. Nebraska currently has a 12-week abortion ban. And in more related news, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's election police unit has been investigating voters who signed ballot petitions for Amendment 4, Florida's abortion rights measure, which would toss out the state's 6-week abortion ban. Since it was formed in 2022, DeSantis's so-called election police have been deployed to intimidate voters, in particular, likely Democratic voters. The Justice Department has charged two leaders of a white supremacist group alleging they plotted to assassinate at least one U.S. senator and a district court judge. Dallas Humber of Elk Grove, California, and Matthew Allison of Boise, Idaho, each face 15 counts of soliciting hate crimes and providing material support to terrorism. Kristen Clark is head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division.
The defendant's goal, the indictment charges, was to ignite a race war, accelerate the collapse of what they viewed as an irreparably corrupt government, and bring about a white ethno state.
Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance is escalating his racist anti-immigrant rhetoric, this time targeting the Haitian community in his home state of Ohio. On Monday, Vance wrote on the social media site X, quote, reports now show that people have had their pets abducted and eaten by people who shouldn't be in this country. Where is our border czar? He asked. The Trump campaign piled on to the bizarre right-wing misinformation campaign, writing, quote, President Trump will deport migrants who eat pets, unquote. The first and currently only scheduled debate between Trump and Kamala Harris is happening tonight on ABC News. You can watch the debate at democracynow.org and tune in tomorrow on Democracy Now! For a recap and analysis of the debate. In Georgia, students at most Barrow County schools are returning to classrooms today, nearly a week after a 14-year-old with an assault rifle shot and killed two other 14-year-old students and two teachers, injuring nine others. Classes at Appalachie High School, where the shooting took place, remain canceled. The Washington Post reports the mother of the suspected shooter contacted the school on the morning of the shooting and warned a counselor about an extreme emergency involving her son about a half hour before the first shots were fired. The warning reportedly came after her son texted her the message, quote, "I'm sorry, Mom." Separate text messages also revealed the family was in contact with school officials about the boy's mental health a week before the massacre. Authorities in California and Nevada have issued mandatory evacuation orders for tens of thousands of people as an intense heat wave grips large swaths of the Southwest. Fast-moving wildfires are burning south of Reno in Nevada and in California's San Bernardino County, Orange County, and at the foothills of LA's National Forest, as well as in Northern California's Lake County. UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain said extreme fire behavior has also been observed in Oregon, Idaho, and Wyoming. In tech news, Google and Apple are facing billions of dollars in fines after losing their respective appeals against the European Union. The European Court of Justice ruled Apple must pay 13 billion euros in back taxes to Ireland in a legal case that spanned 10 years as it went through the appeals process. Separately, Google must pay a 2.4 billion euro fine for favoring its own price comparison shopping service over its rivals. This comes as Google's second major antitrust suit brought by President Biden's Justice Department kicked off Monday. At issue is Google's monopoly over the digital advertising industry. Last month, a federal judge ruled Google operated an illegal monopoly in the online search industry. In Florida, the Miami-Dade Police Department has released footage showing how officers stopped and handcuffed Miami Dolphins star Tyreek Hill as he drove to Sunday's game. The video reveals officers rapidly escalated the situation from a simple traffic stop to a violent detention, twice pressing Hill face down into the pavement, handcuffed.
Get out of the car right now. We're not playing this game. Get out. 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 What part of law don't you understand?
Statement, the Miami Dolphins wrote, "It is both maddening and heartbreaking to watch the very people we trust to protect our community use such unnecessary force and hostility towards these players. Yet it's also a reminder that not every situation like this ends in peace, as we're grateful this one did. What if I wasn't Tyreek Hill is a question that will carry with resounding impact," they wrote. Another Dolphins player, Calais Campbell, who came to de-escalate the situation, was also handcuffed. And legendary actor James Earl Jones has died at the age of 93. He took on iconic blockbuster roles like Star Wars' Darth Vader and Lion King's Mufasa, and is also remembered for films like The Great White Hope and Matewan about the 1920 coal miner strike in West Virginia. Though he became well known for his commanding, booming voice, James Earl Jones overcame a stutter that he said was so debilitating as a child, he sometimes pretended to be nonverbal for years. In 2003, Jones read the Frederick Douglass speech, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July," during a performance of Voices of People's History of the United States, which was co-edited by the late historian Howard Zinn.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim.
We will play more of this performance in Peoples of a History of the United States, James Earl Jones reading the speech of the abolitionist and former enslaved person Frederick Douglass later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the Pakistani-British historian Tariq Ali on Gaza, British arms sales to Israel, Blinken's visit to London today, and more. Stay with us.
Traz a lenha pro fogão, vem fazer armação. Hoje é dia de sol, alegria de coió, é curtir o verão.
Vem, magalenha, rojão, traz a lenha pro fogão, vem fazer armação. Hoje é dia de sol, alegria de coió, é curtir o verão.
Traz a senha pro fogão, TTT coração. Hoje dia de sol, alegria de xodó, meu dever de verão.
Ai! Vem, magalenha, rojão, traz a senha pro fogão, TTT coração.
Magalena, by the Brazilian musician Sergio Mendes, the Grammy-winning pianist and band leader who is credited with helping bring bossa nova to the world, passed away last week at the age of 83. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Britain to meet with the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and the Foreign Secretary David Lammy. The focus is expected to be on the Middle East, Ukraine, and the Asia Pacific. Blinken's meeting comes just days after the United Kingdom announced it's suspending some arms exports to Israel, citing a risk they might be used to commit serious violations of international humanitarian law in Gaza. Britain's new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer of the Labour Party, defended the decision.
This is a serious issue. We either comply with international law or we don't. But we only have strength in our arguments because we comply with international law.
Britain's Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, told the British Parliament last week many weapons exports to Israel would continue, including parts for F-35 fighter jets.
This is not an arms embargo. It targets around 30, approximately 350 licenses to Israel in total for items which could be used in the current conflict in Gaza. The rest will continue.
Oxfam responded to the British government's move by calling for all arms exports to be suspended to Israel. To talk about Britain, Israel's war on Gaza, and much more, we're joined by Tariq Ali, the acclaimed historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review, and the author of over 50 books, including the forthcoming You Can't Please All, Memoirs, 1980 to 2024. He's joining us here in our studio in New York. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Tariq. It's great to have you in person.
Very good to be with you and Juan, Amy. It's been a long time since I've been in this studio, but 12 years almost.
Amazing. Well, today you're here, and Antony Blinken is meeting with Keir Starmer in London and the Foreign Minister David Lammy. There have been massive protests in London around UK policy towards supporting Israel in its war on Gaza. And now you have this stopping of some arms shipments to Israel. Can you talk about UK stance and the UK-US relationship, especially when it comes to Gaza right now in Israel?
The UK, Amy, has been totally complicit in this war. They've sent help. They've sent fighter jets. Their personnel are involved. So for them to pretend somehow that they're an impartial party is utterly ridiculous. This war has been supported by the Conservative government, and it's now being supported by the Labour government. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister you just showed on the screen, as leader of the opposition, supported the genocide in Gaza, supported the cutting off of electricity, supported the cutting off of all water supplies. I think they have received legal advice that they have to do something or they are liable to international law by the courts. Not that that amounts to very much as we see these days. But I think that's the reason they've made a few cuts to the aid. But as they themselves say, these are meaningless. They're purely symbolic. And the bulk of the country now wants aid to Israel and military aid particularly cut off. The anti-war movement in Britain is one of the largest in the world. We've had, I think, now it's almost a year, Amy, since this war began. Almost a year. And we've had dozens and dozens of demonstrations, some including a million people. So the country is opposed to this, you know, across the board. But we have these governments in power. I call them the extreme center governments because right or left, they do the same thing. And why is Blinken visiting Starmer? Normally they send orders online. So why the need for a personal visit is to boost each other's morale? I can see no other reason for it.
And Tariq, it's not just the UK government, but most of the European Union governments. Can you talk about the wide gap between how these governments are dealing with Israel's war on Gaza and the rest of the world, especially the Global South?
Well, the Global South is more or less uniformly hostile to it. This is the biggest divide we've seen in politics almost since the Vietnam War, that the Global South opposed to the war and the West very much in favor of it, Juan. And this comes across very clearly. Now, the other thing is that the demonstrators, you know, Jews, non-Jews, Palestinians, non-Palestinians who've been marching in the streets of Western cities are identifying here very clearly with the Global South. So even in their own homeland, not to mention in the United States, the demonstrations and the campus struggles. So what we are seeing is a big divide on a global level and a divide on an internal level, where large sections, if not majorities, are against what their governments are doing in backing unconditionally what the Israelis have been up to for a year now in Palestine. And this divide is going to continue, given what is going on with the U.S.-China rivalries. And so this gulf now, which has opened up, is going to be difficult to resolve. I mean, whatever else, on foreign policy, I don't think there will be any big change in the United States, regardless of who is elected. The demonstrations still go on a year later all over Europe, including France. The Germans have banned demonstrations. They don't allow them because of their special links to the Judeo side and Holocaust of the Second World War, for which the Palestinians are now being punished. That's what's going on, and it's quite a critical situation because lots of young people who I come across and speak to are challenging and questioning the very nature of democracy, the nature of the system which exists, where one court, international court after the other, has said this genocide must stop, pressure on the International Criminal Court not to prosecute Netanyahu, which has been demanded. And so international law itself has now been questioned. So we are now at a situation where what the United States says goes. The decisions are made in the White House, in the Pentagon, in the State Department. These are the key institutions which determine what happens in Israel. And why the U.S. is doing this puzzles many people who are sympathetic to them. Why are they doing this when we've had presidents like Truman, like Reagan, like Bush Senior, stopping Israel from doing things like this when it was necessary? Now we not a single phone call. Both political parties totally complicit in this war. They might have other disagreements, but on the Gaza war, they are completely united, apart from indies like Jill Stein, who personally I would vote for were I a U.S. citizen, a sort of excellent politician. But apart from her and a few others, there's no one else in the mainstream who's come out against this. And this is very disturbing, I think, for democracy itself and for all its legal political institutions.
And Tariq, I wanted to ask you, in terms of you're talking about the state of democracy in your own homeland of Pakistan, Imran Khan has been detained since for over a year now, accused of inciting violence, a former prime minister. And the UN panel recently had findings that Imran Khan's detention is politically motivated. Do you think there will be any pressure on Pakistan to release him?
So far, there hasn't been any pressure. And Imran Khan, when he was first dismissed from office, claimed that the United States was behind the dismissal because of the positions he had taken on Ukraine at that particular time. He directly accused the State Department of having engineered his dismissal. So the fact that he is still in prison is a sign that the people who control Pakistan are the military. Politicians come and go. Political parties come and go. Politicians change sides in order to gain office. But effectively, Juan, it is the Pakistani army that has run the show for many, many decades. They make the decisions. They choose the politicians, including Imran. He was a military choice. And his successors are military choices. And now they are nervous because normally they can discredit a politician very quickly. They haven't been able to do it in the case of Imran Khan, and all the opinion polls show that were there to be an election in Pakistan, Imran would win by large majorities throughout the country. The army have now made him a martyr, they've made him a popular hero, and he's been locked up in prison on completely frivolous and bogus charges.
So there's also the discussion of banning the PTI party, the Khan party, talking about it. Inciting violence, leaking classified information. What would that mean?
Well, the classified information he revealed, Amy, which should be of interest to viewers here, is that a senior figure from the Pakistan Foreign Office wrote a letter back home from the United States saying that in the United States he had been told in very clear language that Imran had to go. Well, in Pakistan, as in other parts of the world, these letters don't remain secret for too long. So Imran referred to the letter in public, stating something which most people knew. And as a result of that, they've charged him with betraying official secrets. I mean, there was no official secret. Everyone knew this in the first place. And so I think they're determined to get rid of him. Banning his party won't help because his popularity will increase. And if there's another uprising like we've seen in Bangladesh recently that could erupt in Pakistan, then they've had it. I mean, they'll have to shoot people on the streets and we'll see a repeat of the uprisings of the 60s and 70s.
And Tariq, I wanted to ask you about Bangladesh. The supporters of the former prime minister, Sheikh Hasina, have claimed that the United States was behind that as well, that it wasn't really a popular uprising as much as a color revolution. I'm wondering your thoughts. Is there any credible evidence that that is so?
I don't think so, Juan. I mean, you know, because the United States has done these things in the past, it can't do them everywhere. And what we saw in Bangladesh was a very authoritarian government confronted largely by students demanding democratic rights and freedoms and an end to laws which they regard as anti-democratic. And they won. She ran. She was taken by a special plane waiting for her to India and is now blaming the United States for this. In my opinion, there is no evidence to show U.S. involvement so far. Some may come out. We will see. But I think more disturbing is that the students who replaced her had no real alternative. So quite a few unprincipled parties, political parties and politicians who were there and are now in power or close to it are mistreating Awami League supporters, and that too is unacceptable. But in Bangladesh, as in Pakistan, behind the scenes in Bangladesh, it's the military who rules. The appointment of a sort of banker who became a celebrity and won the Nobel Prize, Dr. Yunus, very, very aged man, older even than me, and he is not going to be able to deliver anything. Behind him, it's the army.
I wanted to go to what's happening in France. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets Saturday protesting President Macron's appointment of the conservative Michel Barnier as the new prime minister, even though leftist parties won the most votes in July's snap parliamentary elections. This is the leader of the leftist Unbowed Party, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, speaking last week.
L'élection a donc été volée au peuple français.
And so the election has been stolen from the French people. The message has been denied, and now we're finding out about a prime minister that was named with the permission and maybe on the suggestion of the far-right national rally. Knowing that the second round of the legislative election has been entirely concentrated on making this national rally fail.
So that's Jean-Luc Mélenchon, head of Unbowed. You have the leftists winning and the president, Macron, who called the snap election and yet lost it, giving the prime ministership to the right.
It's appalling, Amy. I mean, this is, you know, the sort of trend we see in most of the Western world, a very authoritarian approach to politics if they lose. And Jean-Luc Mélenchon was determined to fight. He created a new united front with the socialists and all progressive parties to make sure that the extreme right-wing party of Marine Le Pen was defeated. Macron had said before the election, let the far right come to power, they'll discredit themselves. Well, that didn't happen because of the campaign waged by La France Insoumise and Jean-Luc Mélenchon in particular. Effectively, they created a united front which defeated the far right, and this spoiled brat, Macron, who came up from nowhere, you know, a sort of technocrat politician, now operates as if he's a statesman. I think he has discredited himself considerably. And we shall see. He had a meeting with the far right. He has not met Mélenchon once. He's made it clear that he's not going to appoint a president from the group or the bloc which got the largest votes. And this is the trend I was referring to earlier. They feel they can get away with anything. And there have been demonstrations. There have been a few strikes as well. But there's been no big protest from the so-called international community, i.e. the State Department in D.C. You know, no protest from Foggy Bottom at all that this is intolerable behavior, because, you know, they tolerate it when their own allies do it. How it's going to turn out for Macron, we shall see. I think there is now 52% voted for his impeachment. I mean, in opinion polls, 52% of French people said that Macron should be prosecuted and impeached. So he's divided the country quite sharply. So we'll see what he does. I mean, Barnier is a joke figure. He got 4% of the vote and he's been appointed prime minister. I mean, what's needed in France, actually, to be serious, is an abolition of this Fifth Republic that was created by de Gaulle after he seized power as a general in 1958. And it was designed to give the president maximum powers. It's not a democratic state, you know, in any sense of the word. The democracy has tried to push through it. And so we need a new republic. And, you know, Mélenchon has been arguing, and many of us have been, let's have elections to a constituent assembly to choose and draft a new constitution. We need a sixth republic in France, because the Fifth Republic has failed.
And Tariq, I wanted to ask you, though, across Europe, the extreme right wing, especially anti-immigrant parties, have been gaining strength, even though in Britain and France they've been beaten back. But even the center has become increasingly more anti-immigrant, anti-African, anti-Arab, anti-the United States, Latin American. What's your sense of the prospects for progressives and radicals to win popular support, given that sectors of the working class and the middle classes are falling prey to this anti-immigrant phobia?
Juan, this is always the case at times of crisis, social, political, economic, that people from the working class and the middle class, as you call it here, get carried away. It's a simple propaganda. We don't have enough jobs. We don't have enough money. Look at these people coming from outside. Well, in Europe, you can say that. But in the United States, as I always point out, everyone has come from the outside except Native Americans. So what is the big deal that, you know, you now just want to exclude people of color? In Europe, of course, they went and searched for workers all over the former colonies, because after the Second World War, there's a big shortage of labor. And what they did effectively was to go and plead with West Indian black nurses to come and run the British National Health Service, for workers to come and run the factories. And this is a population which they are now targeting. But the most reprehensible feature of this, as you point out, is that mainstream politicians have not managed to frontally take on these arguments. In fact, in the new Labour government, you have politicians sort of slyly saying, well, yes, there are problems. We have too many immigrants. Labour is working very hard to try and stop the flow. And the result of this is illegal gangs promising migrants in poverty-stricken countries or countries where you have large numbers of people dislodged by wars, as we see in the Middle East today, and as we've seen for the last 5 or 6 years, who want to come and seek refuge. And they're being denied entry into the countries which have made these wars. And in effect, many of them are drowning in boats in the English Channel, just dropping dead, being pushed out by unscrupulous gangsters who promise them that they'll get them in illegally. So it's a really grim situation on that front. And this is now in Germany too, that in recent state elections in the former Eastern Germany, Thuringia, the far right party AfD won the largest vote. I mean, you know, they can still be outvoted, but they won a large vote. And this is spreading in other parts of Germany too, which also takes in the fact that if some of these far-right groups are saying, why are we backing a war with Russia? Why are we supporting Ukraine? It's not in our national interest. Why are we following the Americans? So it's immigration and a lot of other issues actually being tied together by these parties. And the extreme center governments, center left and center right, do nothing. They're actually provoking this by doing nothing at all.
Well, Tariq Ali, we want to thank you for being with us and in our studio. We look forward to having you back to talk about your memoirs when they are released. Tariq Ali is a British-Pakistani historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review, the author of over 50 books, including the forthcoming You Can't Please All, Memoirs 1980 to 2024, in from London here in New York City. Coming up, as the official death toll in Gaza tops 41,000, we talked to former U.S. presidential candidate Ralph Nader about how the current death toll that is being repeated around the world may be a vast undercount. We'll also be speaking with him about the upcoming debate, maybe the only one, between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Stay with us.
Soon on the Dunbar end,
everyone sang.
When strangers became your new best friends,
everyone sang.
It was Armistice Day and peace broke out,
everyone sang.
Sometimes a melody is louder than a shout,
everyone sang.
Somebody struck up a song. We didn't know the words, but still we sang along. Just our voices, that's all. Everywhere a concert hall, voices, that's all. Lullaby and
Voices, That's All, by Chumbawamba, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We continue to look at Israel's war on Gaza, where the official death toll has topped 41,000 Palestinians. So that could be a vast undercount that doesn't include those remain trapped in the rubble and the people and children who've died due to chronic illnesses, infectious diseases spreading across Gaza. Over the past 11 months, Israel's destroyed Gaza's health system and other crucial infrastructure, placed a blockade on medications and other urgent aid. More than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza also risk imminent famine, with children starving at a record rate. The UN's humanitarian aid chief, Martin Griffiths, has said life is draining out of Gaza at terrifying speed. Unquote. Even some Biden administration officials have admitted the Gaza death toll could be significantly higher. This is Barbara Leaf, Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, speaking last November.
In this period of conflict and conditions of war, it is very difficult for any of us to assess what the rate of casualties are. We think they're very high, frankly, and it could be that they're even higher than are being cited. We'll know only after the guns fall silent. So we take in sourcing from a variety of folks who are on the ground, and so I can't stipulate to one figure or another, but I think it's very possible that they're even higher than is being reported.
That was Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs Barbara Leaf. The prestigious British medical journal Lancet has estimated the actual death toll could be 186,000 or even higher, roughly 8% of Gaza's population. The report looks at how war leads to indirect deaths due to shortages of medical care, food, shelter and water. This all comes as protests continue, demanding the U.S. government immediately halt its military aid to Israel and calling on Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris, who's debating Donald Trump tonight in Philadelphia, to shift her policies on Gaza. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate, four times. He's the author of many books, including most recently, Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country that Works for the People. Ralph Nader is the founder of the monthly print-only newspaper, Capitol Hill Citizen, where his front page article in the latest issue is headlined Exposing the Gaza Death Undercount. Ralph, in a moment, we want to talk to you about the debate tonight and talk about the Democratic and Republican parties' approach to as you talk about the corporate state. But let's start with this undercount. What you are saying is so much higher, the death toll in Gaza, than what we understand.
Hello?
Hi, Ralph. Hi, Ralph. Can you hear me? It sounds like Ralph Nader can't hear us. Ralph, are you there? We're going to go to, well, why don't we go to our last segment, which is James Earl Jones, who just died at the age of 93, reading in a Voices of the People's History of the United States performance, the words of Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, the former enslaved person. He is reading from Voices of a People's History of the United States by the late great historian Howard Zinn.
Frederick Douglass, once a slave, became a brilliant and powerful leader of the anti-slavery movement. In 1852, he was asked to speak in celebration of the 4th of July.
Fellow citizens, pardon me and allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There's not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. At a time like this, scorching irony Not convincing argument is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a stream, a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
That was James Earl Jones reading the words of Frederick Douglass' speech, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July. That was during a performance of Voices of a People's History of the United States, which was co-edited by the late great historian Howard Zinn. James Earl Jones, famous for his booming voice as a child, stuttered so badly that for years he chose almost not to speak at all. James Earl Jones has died at the age of 93. We turn now back to Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate, founder of the monthly print-only newspaper, The Capitol Hill Citizen. His front-page piece in the current edition is headlined Exposing the Gaza Death Undercount. Ralph, why don't you lay out for us why you don't believe the count is, what are we at this point, something like 41,000 dead, more than 16,000 of them Palestinian. Palestinian children, Ralph.
And Amy, this is a horrifyingly undercount, and it has political rationale for it. If the true count was known, it would devastate the mythology that the Biden administration and Congress are furthering, that the Israeli government does not purposely target civilian populations and therefore violate all kinds of U.S. laws conditioning the shipment of weapons to Israel and international laws. So I put together in this article in the Capitol Citizen, people can go to capitolcitizen.com and get it, the various probative evidence that shows that experts who are blocked from getting additional data that the State Department has and is keeping secret, that the evidence shows that it's well over 300,000, and it may double by the end of the year. In an article in The Guardian by the distinguished chair of global public health at the University of Edinburgh, titled Scientists Are Closing In on the True Horrifying Scale of Death and Disease in Gaza, she estimates over 300,000 before the end of the year, pointing out with the Lancet report that you mentioned that the Lancet people used a very conservative estimate, but allowed that the number could easily be much higher. And so why is this happening? Why are all sides, the anti-genocide side, Israeli, the Hamas, why are they always using these figures? Because for different reasons, it serves their political purposes. Hamas doesn't want their true count to be known because it will be assailed by its own people and its international allies as unable to protect its own people and provide shelters. Netanyahu, of course, wants it lowballed for obvious reasons, and Biden for the same reason. So what do these scientists see? They see a tiny enclave, the geographical size of Philadelphia, with 2.3 million people, crowded, already sick and destitute from years of Israeli illegal embargoes, high levels of anemia among the children before October 7th. And then starting October 8th, the Israeli military issued the genocidal orders of no food, no water, no medicine, no electricity, no fuel. And they proceeded accordingly. And so what these scientists are seeing are what's called the empirical evidence that people on social media are seeing in others. With over 130,000 bombs and missiles, plus daily tank shelling, ruthless sniper fire, there's been massive destruction of apartment buildings, congested marketplaces, refugee camps, hospitals, over 150 health clinics, masses of families huddled in schools being blown up, ambulance being blown up, bakeries destroyed, schools, universities, mosques, churches, roads, electricity networks, critical water mains, just about everyone and everything. And some people, partisans of Netanyahu, will say, oh, the Israeli government never targets civilians. Historically, they've always targeted civilians. Go back to the early 80s when former Israeli ambassador and foreign minister Abba Iban wrote of Israel under then Prime Minister Menachem Begin that Israel, and I'm quoting him, quote, is wantonly inflicting every possible measure of death and anguish on civilian populations in a mood reminiscent of regimes which neither Mr. Begin nor I would dare to mention by name, end quote. And just a few years earlier, in the late 70s, Israel's leading military analyst, summing up remarks by the Israeli chief of staff, stated the following. The quote, the Israeli army has always struck civilian populations, purposefully and consciously. The army has never distinguished civilian from military targets, but purposely attacked civilian targets, end quote. And why is this important? Because to this day, all of the administration's spokespeople are denying that Israel has targeted civilians, denying that Israel has violated international genocide laws, denying that they have violated six federal statutes conditioning shipment of weapons to foreign countries on recognizing human rights excessively. To this administration and to the Congress, all deaths of civilians are accidental. Blowing up schools, sheltering refugees, well, that was a mistake. So that's why it's important, Amy, and Juan, to get that estimate as reliably high as possible. We are seeing possibly a million deaths before the end of the year. We have starvation, we have infectious diseases. All the doctors that you've had on Democracy Now! Have provided the clinical evidence of what's going on. 5,000 babies born every month into the rubble, contaminated water, horrific air pollution with heavy metals from the bombing, and no food. We're led to believe by these 41,000 figures that 98% or more of the is a Palestinian population still alive? I mean, what are they made of, asbestos and steel? And as the doctors have said on your program, when they went back to the rubble and the broken hospitals, they didn't meet anybody in Gaza who wasn't sick or injured. There's an interview in February in Al Jazeera by a Gaza undertaker who's doing this free of charge and crying every day with his assistants on the open graves. He says he's buried 17,000 bodies, including 800 in one day, and that was back in February.
Ralph, I wanted to ask you, in addition to the bombings and the killings of civilians, Israel has also refused to allow foreign press to come into Gaza and has systematically been killing those journalists, those Palestinians within Gaza who are reporting. Talk about this attack on the press that really has not gotten much of much outrage in the West.
Yeah, I mean, how weak can you get as a president of the United States or a member of Congress when you can't even demand that Netanyahu let foreign and Israeli journalists, including U.S. journalists, into Gaza to freely report. He's been blocking this for years. And he Israeli military is targeted, as you indicated, Palestinian journalists. They've killed over 165 of them, including, in addition to members of their own family, targeting apartments, for example. They've killed over 200 members of UNRWA, the UN Relief. They're out to destroy every relief center, every food feeding center of UNRWA, education center. Right now, let's put it in comparative terms here. More Palestinians have been killed since October 8th than have been killed by the U.S. in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Dresden. Now, that total death toll was about 240,000 people. And those deaths were in countries, Germany and Japan, with 160 million population. Here we only have 2.3 million population. And all you got to do is read the Israeli press, read Haaretz, read the statements by 17 Israeli human rights groups.
Ralph Nader, we want to thank you for being with us, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, four-time former presidential candidate. We'll link to your article in the Capitol Hill Citizen, Exposing the Gaza Death Undercount. That does it for our show. Watch tonight's debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This September, KPP Concerts presents a stacked lineup of shows at the Broom Factory featuring everything from big-name acts to local gems. On September 12th, check out punk legends DOA with opening sets by The Meringues and Owl Farm. On September 13th, Kingston's own Oak Ridge Avenue hits the stage with Ottawa Rockers, The New Hires. On September 14th, pop punk and emo cover band Strike Tyson will play alongside local acts Sonic Souvenir and Squid Pistol. September 15th, folk singer Katie Tupper will play a matinee with Kingston's own Luella opening the show. On September 16th, punk heavyweights Authority Zero and Belvedere with special guests Melon Ball are performing. On September 18th, the legendary Martha Wainwright plays live in Kingston. On September 20th, local rockers Cassador return to the Broom Factory with Sparrow Blue. On September 21st, Nova Scotia's Mo Kenny will play a show. And on September 28th, don't miss Virginia to Vegas with special guest Alex Porat. For more information and